It is a privilege to have Narayana Kocher Lakota, our president of our Minneapolis Fed. I have the privilege of serving on the Minneapolis Fed board, and I have to have a true confession. When I was asked to join the board in the summer of 2008, I thought, well, this will be another boring board in June of 2008. And some things happened in the fall of 2008, and so my first meeting, I didn't know what I was getting into. And we always knew of economics as the dismal science, but I can tell you it's become one of the most interesting learning experiences. We had a luncheon today, and Jake Marvin, who was our Fed chair for 2 years during the great challenges of the crisis following 2008, and Jake put into words what I can also say. It's just been a high privilege to be involved in serving. We have a lot of people like Jake Marvin from Warroad, who has a big presence here. Randy Newman from Grand Forks is now a banker serving on our board, and we have, I believe, a couple advisory board, current or former advisory board members, Doug Melby, and is Brad Schlossman in the room? And Brad, so we have anybody else who's been an advisory board member of the Fed that is in the room, I'd like to recognize you. But also this evening, we have Dorothy Bridges, who's our Senior VP of Public Affairs, Community Outreach, and about three other things. And she's been very involved in helping get Narayana out to various places. And then we have a native son of North Dakota, David Fettig, who's our from Bismarck, who's in the back of the room, who is our VP of Public Affairs. And for any of you who have a Twitter question or a question you want to text, David will monitor those. We'll put them up on the screen. And I must say, we've got some great questions submitted by you in advance. And we probably can spend the whole time just in those questions, but if we have a lot more questions, if you don't do Twitter, you don't do text, you can raise your hand the old-fashioned way, and we'll take your questions as well. Narayana was born in Baltimore, but grew up in Winnipeg. And so he's got roots in the Red River Valley. And this is hard to believe, how anybody can get into Princeton at the age of 15 and study math, but Narayana went to Princeton at the ripe old age of 15 and graduated there, and then did his PhD at the University of Chicago, and has served as a faculty member at a number of prominent schools, and Northwestern, Stanford, and other schools, and was chair of the economics department at the University of Minnesota, taking it to one of the top 10 econ departments in the country. We could go into a lot of his papers and stuff that he's done, but you can all Google that and read that online. What I'd like to say briefly is we give feedback every year to our president, and if you read the feedback that Narayana gets, you'd understand how deeply he is appreciated. Patiently answering questions from some of us who sometimes don't appear to know what we're talking about when we ask about big macroeconomic questions or questions about the economies of foreign banks, the European Central Bank, or whatever. And he is very, very skilled at taking very complex subjects and delivering them to us in a way that is most helpful. And has a great sense of humor, and makes our meetings a lot of fun. And so we have deeply appreciated the leadership that he's given to the 9th District, which is Northern Michigan, Northwest Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Dakotas, and Montana. We have a big geographical area, but a small population base. And so instead of taking any more time, I think what we'll do is bring Narayana up, and we're going to sit side by side. I'm going to start by reading some of the questions that have been submitted. We'll David's going to raise his hand when you send in a Twitter question, and then we'll, in fact, if you don't have Twitter, don't have a cell phone to text, and have a strong desire to ask a question, raise your hand, and I'll look around the room, and we'll get you in. So, Narayana, why don't you come on up, and we'll
well, thanks a lot, Howard.
We'll begin.
I do want to say that I very much appreciate the generous introduction. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be back here in Fargo, and I want to thank Howard and Doug and Brad for their service to Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis as director, in Howard's case, and members of our advisory council. But it is a pleasure to be back in Fargo. That I remember coming here with my parents a long time ago. The West Acres Mall was just newly opened, so that's a while ago. But it's great to be back.
Well, we'll start. And the questions, some great questions that were submitted, and we'll see how you do with these questions. Some people are looking for silver bullets and real simple answers, but obviously we know that's a bit more complicated. But monetary policies had meager effectiveness thus far in stimulating output and reviving the economy. What more, if anything, do you think the Federal Reserve could and should be doing to help spur the economy?
Yeah, this is a great question. We had a very deep recession in the United States. Dated as beginning December 2007. At that point, the unemployment rate in the United States was 5%. And it rose throughout the recession. The recession is dated as ending in June of 2009. But the unemployment rate kept rising after that until it peaked to 10% in October 2009. So a very deep recession. But even more troubling about how deep the recession's been has been how slow the recovery's been. Here we are, I just mentioned the date October 2009, so here we are 4.5 years later, and the unemployment rate is still only back down to 6.7%. And in a lot of ways, that measure that we're all so familiar with as a measure of labor market performance is an understatement of how deep the problems remain in the labor market. If you look at other measures, how many people have a job, or how many people have a job but would like to work more hours, you see even deeper problems than that 6.7% represents. So the recovery has been very slow, and I think that's what the questioner is referring to, is that the recovery has been very slow. And this is despite the fact that monetary policy, Federal Open Market Committee, on which I serve, we've chosen to keep the short-term interbank lending rate, the Fed funds rate. The Fed is targeting a Fed funds rate between 0.25 percentage points. Now, you can't really get any lower than that, and has been doing so since December 2008. So it seems like we've had a lot of monetary policy stimulus in place, and beyond that, we've also bought a large amount of assets. Our balance sheet has grown up a lot. Again, that should be another form of stimulus. So it seems like we've got a slow recovery, and monetary policy has had a very little effect. But I think this is the wrong way to think about it. I think what the better analogy is that we've had something analogous to a very tough winter. You know, that's what the economic shock that hit us was. And the Fed has done the best it could in face of that tough shock, and has, I think, promoted a better recovery than we would have had in the absence of Fed actions. But the shock has been a very challenging one. And what the Fed would have liked to have been able to do is to lower the interest rate still further. That's what the traditional response would have been to this kind of situation. But we could not, because of the fact that we're targeting interest rate between 0 and 25 basis points. I think the right way to think about this is, boy, how bad would the recession have been, and how slow would the recovery have been if the Fed had not lowered interest rates to 0 in December 2008? Had it kept them at something more traditional, like 4%, and I think the recession would have been much deeper, I think the recovery would be even slower, and inflation would be even lower. So what more can the Fed do now is the next question. And I think the right answer to that is, it's not a lot of what monetary policy is about is not what you do at a given meeting at a given moment in time. It's about people's expectations of how you're going to behave in the future with monetary policy. If people think that you're going to raise rates very soon, that's going to mean one thing for their behavior. They're going to be worried about, their decision making is going to be, maybe I should wait and save my money as opposed to investing. And because of the rate of return I'm going to be getting on my savings is going to be going up soon. Whereas if you commit to keeping rates low, even as the recovery is proceeding, even as we continue to recover, I think people have a sense that the Fed has the recovery's back. And that's the message that I think we need to do a better job of promoting, that the Fed does have the recovery's back and is prepared to remain accommodative even as the recovery proceeds. We can afford to do that because the real cost of monetary stimulus, what you worry about, is having inflation get too high. And that's not the problem we face right now. Inflation is running close to 1%, and what we associate with price stability as a good inflation rate, target inflation rate of the country is 2%. So we've got a lot of room there to work with as well. So we can afford to stay accommodative as the recovery proceeds, and that's, I think we need to be more clear in our communication that we're prepared to do that.
Good, thanks. Next question is, since the 2008 recession, the Fed has been purchasing a large amount of long-term treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, or quantitative easing. With interest rates at an all-time low, can you talk about interest rate risk? I'm assuming the question is, if we see rates go up 2-3%, what interest rates go up, what happens? And how will the Fed prevent a spike in interest rates in the future?
So, again, provide a little bit of context for this. Beginning in late 2008 or early 2009, once the Fed funds rate was down near zero, the Fed, in order to provide more stimulus, the FOMC, in order to provide more stimulus to the economy, embarked in a program of buying long-term assets. And now these were, just to be clear what they are, they were long-term treasuries, so that issued by the U.S. government, and then also mortgage-backed securities that were implicitly backed by the U.S. government. Now, all this is designed to try to put downward pressure on long-term interest rates. When you buy bonds, what you're doing is going to be pushing downward on long-term interest rates in order to, again, to make people think, boy, interest rates are really low. I'm better off spending my money or investing my money as opposed to, that is, building a factory, as opposed to putting my money in a savings account somewhere. So that's what the goal of the policy was. Now the question is about the Fed has been successful, I think, in promoting a very low interest rate profile going forward. It's not actually as low as it was a year ago. A year ago, rate of return on 10-year treasuries, the yield on 10-year treasuries, was about 1.7%, which would have been historically low. Now we're about one percentage point higher than that. I'll say two things in response to the question. What's going to happen to interest rates is sort of the question. This is what monetary policy policymakers always get asked. And the first answer is what I expect to happen. And the first answer, that answer is I expect interest rates to rise gradually as the recovery continues, as the economy improves. We start to see a little more pricing pressure, pricing power on the part of firms. I think we'll see a need to raise rates, and I think that will be slow. So that's my best expectation at this point. But the right answer to this question is that I cannot make any assurance about interest rates. And here's why. When the Fed, we make monetary policy, it's not in order to control interest rates or set them at some level. That's our instrument in order to achieve our goals. And our goals are to keep inflation at 2% and to promote maximum employment, to keep unemployment low. If keeping inflation at 2%, if we see inflationary pressures develop sufficiently rapidly, we will raise rates rapidly in order to contain those inflationary pressures. Now, the good news is that's a situation you're going to want to have, because that's going to happen when the economy is running very robustly. That's when you're going to see inflation start to rise so that the Fed has to raise rates. But I can say what I expect to happen, but I can't guarantee you a path of interest rates, because that's what the instrument that we use in order to achieve our goals. What I can say is that I'm fully committed to doing whatever it takes to keep inflation close to 2%. And if we start to see inflationary pressures so that inflation starts to go above its current 1% level up to closer to 2 or rising above 2, then that's when rates will rise.
Maybe a follow-up in there. Yeah. At times, I've heard you express deep concern about deflation over the past 5 years. There have been times when you've just had this fear that we might be entering a deflationary environment. And AKA, you know, you look at Japan and what they went through. And is that still a concern of yours?
I'm concerned that inflation is as low as it is. I think that inflation right now, as I mentioned, is running at 1, and our target is 2. The good news is that longer-term inflation expectations continue to be close to 2, and that's positive news. But you know, if you had to ask me, am I more worried about inflation being low as opposed to high? I'm more worried about its being high, being low, I should say, to be clear. I'm more worried about its being low, because I think that our tools to deal with that are more limited. If I started to see inflation going above 2, that's central banking 101. Yeah. Given inflation as low as it is, people ask the questions like the first one, what can the Fed do about that?
Next question is, there's much talk about the low labor force participation rate. However, that downward trend actually started around 2001. What is driving this trend, and is it bad or is it good?
Wow, that's another good question. I think so labor force participation rate peaked around 2001, and it's not true that it's been steadily coming downwards, but it is true that after the recovery during the 2000 period, it did not rise back up as high as it had been at 2001. And so I think the right way to answer this question is to think about why was labor force participation as high as it was in 2001? Because I actually worked in the Minneapolis Fed Research Department in the mid-90s, and we struggled with the following question: why was labor force participation rising so rapidly? And that was actually a very challenging, and I'm not sure we fully answered it, but what we've seen over the last 30 years or so is that male labor force participation has been declining. As I said, this goes back at least 30 years. Female labor force participation rose beginning in the early 70s through about 2000 or so, and then has stabilized. So that's what gives rise to the fact that we peaked in 2001 and have been coming down somewhat since then. I think during the slow recovery that we've been going through, we've seen further very large declines in labor force participation. A big question for us is to sort out, is this just people deciding they don't want to work given the conditions of their lives? And by us, I mean monetary policymakers. If that's the case, then when we try to provide stimulus and firms go out and try to have demand for their products as a result of monetary stimulus, then that's going to put upward pressure on wages because people are staying home because they don't want to work, and that's going to lead to inflation. On the other hand, if you think that that decline in labor force participation that's taken place more recently is due to the fact that people would like to work, but they've gotten discouraged of keeping on looking for work, and they'd come back in to the labor force if they saw firms looking for jobs, looking for workers, then stimulus can be provided more safely. I think some of the decline since 2001 is definitely, economists like to use the word structural. It's something that's going to be with us over the longer term. But I think a lot of it remains something that is amenable to treatment through monetary policy, that it's cyclical.
So to be clear, we were at 65% or 66 for a peak, and now 59 or 60
so participation? The participation rates are not as dramatic as that. I'm not going to remember the numbers off the top of my head, I'm afraid. Unemployment to population, to talk a little bit what those numbers mean. So on the labor force participation rate is the fraction of people over the age of 16 that are either employed or have looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. That's what's called the labor force participation rate. The employment to population ratio is a fraction of the people over the age of 16 who have a job. Now that was, in 2007, that number of fraction of people who had a job was 62.7% in December 2007. Okay. That had fell at the lowest, got to in the recession, and in the slow recovery, was about 58.1%. So from 62.7 down to 58.1%. We're still not back up to 59. We've made progress. Okay.
Yeah. Well, next question is, I think somebody who wants your job. How did you become president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis? It might be a student looking for a career path, which is a good one. And what was your journey? And then what do you expect from your employees? So very personal.
Well, I have to be careful what I say about what I expect from my employees. Well, maybe I'm supposed to tell my employees what I expect from them. So that would be good, I guess. Some of them are back there. So, let me talk about, this is a hard question actually for me, because I'm not usually don't like to, I don't think about these personal things that much, but.
Well, maybe you didn't aspire to be president of if you were looking at a career as a professor and research economist.
Absolutely. So I grew up in Winnipeg, as Howard mentioned. Both my parents were professors of statistics at the University of Manitoba. I could never say that word, so I chose not to go into that field. I was certainly inspired by their example to pursue academics, as you mentioned, got my PhD in economics at Chicago and pursued a career as a professor, and was very happy doing that. And certainly the crisis really changed my thinking about what I wanted out of my life and what I wanted to do. I remember doing an interview with National Public Radio in October 2008. So this is during the peak of the crisis, really. And the way these radio interviews work is they'll interview for 2 hours or something and then use 2 minutes of sound bites. But one of the questions that was asked in that 2 hours was, what are you thinking? What are you feeling right now as an economist, someone who had been a professor for 20 years or something like that? And my response to that was that I really felt like I wanted to serve my country at this stage. I certainly didn't know the answers, but I felt like I could be of help in seeking out the answers. And so that's why I went from being a professor and then the job opened up shortly thereafter. My predecessor Gary Stern retired. So what's the lessons from that? I mean, I think that, first of all, being a president of a Fed or serving on the Federal Open Market Committee is really about having technical expertise in the area of economics. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've seen throughout my career as an economist, I was an academic, but many of my students went on to do work in public service. They worked on Wall Street. There's just if you want to have a wide range of professional opportunities available to you, doing an undergraduate degree in economics and doing postgraduate work in economics is just a fantastic, it just opens up a number of different career opportunities. And the other thing is to keep yourself open to new opportunities that may not seem that obvious. And I've greatly enjoyed this one, I have to say.
Well, I wasn't on the search committee, but after it was narrowed to 6 candidates, I had the privilege of sitting in the interviews with the various candidates. And I can tell you there was very impressive people that wanted the job in Minneapolis, but it was a unanimous selection at Narayana was by far the best. And so you came October of 2009.
2009.
So that was during my first year there. So what do you expect from your employees?
You know, I expect they're laughing. I mean, I think the serious answer to this is something that Jake actually talked about at launch is, you know, standard. The Federal Reserve System in general expects a standard professionalism, dedication to public service, integrity, and hard work from its employees. And I can tell you, I've never been disappointed on that front from the people of the Minneapolis Fed. Yeah. It's just a great group of people to work with.
I agree with that. So what is the most important decision you've made in your life that helped you get where you are now? So as you look at, I'm sure that one decision might be, what are the most important things that have shaped who you are and where you are today?
Yeah, so I assume this question again came from a student. So, and because when you're young, I remember thinking, boy, I've made this decision about what course to take and it's messed up my life or something like that. And it's not like that. I mean, there's just a whole series of decisions you end up making, and that your life just ends up being a culmination of those decisions. For me, when I was thinking back on this question, the most important decisions you make are, you'll meet people in your life who you admire, and thinking about how to emulate them and seeking out the characteristics that they have that you want to emulate and how to be like them. So for me, you know, my parents certainly were a huge influence on me when I was growing up. My PhD advisor, Lars Hansen, just a tremendous role model in terms of his dedication to work, just the absolute integrity he brought to everything that he did.
What happened with him this past year?
Oh, Lars? Yeah, no, Lars won the Nobel Prize in Economics. That's
And did you get to be there with him?
Yeah, no, So that's another attribute of Lars that I'm still working on getting to. Lars is an incredibly generous human being. So he was nice enough to invite three former PhD students and their spouses along to. So when you get the Nobel Prize in Economics, there's a huge ceremony in Sweden, and you get to invite I think about 12 or 15 guests. And he was nice enough to invite three former PhD students, including myself and our spouses. It was an incredibly rewarding experience that you can get a little flavor of online. If you go to the Nobel Prize site, you can actually see the ceremony, and you can see the banquet, which was really just an extraordinary event, I have to say. 1,200 people being served in one room at one time.
So for you students out here, get close to one of your faculty members who's going to be a future Nobel Prize winner and hitch your wagon to them. David, we got a Twitter question?
We have a lot of questions.
A lot?
Yeah.
Okay. Is income inequality hurting the U.S. economy?
Wow, that's a great question, and it's a great question because you'll just hear a lot of different viewpoints on this. I think that the first starting point is to answer this kind of question is to just think about income inequality in and of itself, and the fact that some people end up earning a lot more than others. And what do we make of that? And how do we deal with that as a society? Are we comfortable with the fact that some people are born with the skills and with the parental support and into the environment that allows them to be to have the success that allows them to earn a lot of money, and others are not as fortunate? That's a sort of a risk that faces people. And the question is, how do we deal with that as a society? So that's one aspect of this question is just what does income inequality mean for us as a society? How do we want it to deal with that? And you know, that's why we have social insurance programs. That's why we have a progressive tax system, is to try to deal with that through the government in that way. There's another sense in which people ask this question sometimes is simply that the increase in income inequality, and there has been an increase in income inequality in the United States over the past 30 years or so, is that lowering the demand for goods and services? So you could think about the fact that people who are poor might be more willing to spend a dollar than somebody who's really super rich. And so if you have, are taking money from people who are poor and giving it to people who are super rich, and that's what spreading out, making income, making more in income inequality, you can make an argument that you're creating lower demand for goods and services. That, I think, that second piece is more controversial and is still being sorted out, I would say, by economists. The first piece is one that economists have struggled with for years and years and years, which the first piece meaning the idea that some people are born with the attributes and the good fortune in a number of ways to allow them to earn a lot of money and have a lot of and have high incomes and others are not. If you do too much, of course, to correct that risk, to correct that form of risk, you can end up killing incentives to actually work. So that's the trade-off that you constantly face. But what you'll hear many economists speculate is the second force I mentioned, which is inequality actually is a drag on demand, and that's actually then a drag on overall economic performance. And I don't have a strong feeling on that second question.
So Bubba Watson will make more money at golf than you will?
That's a pretty safe statement,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we'll go back and forth, David. Because this one, I think, is a concern for a lot of people in this region. Agricultural commodity prices and land prices. Are you concerned about a potential bursting land price bubble, as we certainly saw throughout the 80s and in the 20s? There was a huge increase in land right after World War I, and then a huge crash. And so we've seen that in our region a couple times, a big crisis. So I think somebody is wanting to hear your thoughts on the really high land prices.
Yeah, I think I'll say a couple things about this. Certainly, we've seen a very big run-up in land prices. People in this room know this better than I do. And I think when you see those kinds of run-ups, there's a question about, you know, that there, some of the rates of increase that we saw in 2012, for example, in parts of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, those rates of increase were not sustainable. Okay, that is, prices could not keep growing at that same rate year after year after year after year. That everyone could forecast, because otherwise the price of land would get to be higher than the value of all the goods and services in the world. That wasn't going to happen. So you know that some, you see prices, an asset price or land price growing at 10% per year, say, you know that can't continue forever. And then the question becomes, what happens next? Will it keep slow down to grow at a quote-unquote more normal rate of 2%? Will it fall slightly, fall a lot? I think there's just a huge number of uncertainties. It's not inevitable that you see these large run-ups in prices and you see a fall of 30 or 40%, which is what I think the questioner is probably concerned about. You know, more recently, I think we've seen some stabilization in prices. We're not seeing this same pattern of increases. You know, it depends where you are in North Dakota, but throughout the district, I would say overall, we're seeing some stabilization. But the one thing that gives me less concern about a bursting land price bubble than, say, in the 80s is a lot of the land purchases this time around have been financed with cash or with equity, and there's a lot less debt finance. So what concerns me as a central banker or as a policymaker is if people are borrowing a lot to buy land and then the land goes down a lot in value, then that can create a problem at that point. It's less of an issue if people are financing through cash.
So you said inflation was at about 1%, but we know that consumables have been climbing, like food, gas, utilities, education. This is where consumers spend their dollars. What does your inflation measure cover? Very good question.
Covers all these things. And in fact, gas hasn't been rising. So that, I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, if I go back far enough, if I go back over the last 5 years or so, or go back to 2008, gas, I think, was higher then than it is now. So actually, if you think about trying to create 2% inflation, we actually have to offset the decline in gas prices. That's negative inflation at that stage. I think this question is a great one, because it's really important. I think it indicates the importance of actually if you going in and seeing the data, looking at the data, tracking where are these things coming from. It's true that actually the last month or so, food prices have been running up relatively rapidly. So that's right. But that's just 1 month. And you have to have this look back over the full year, look back over the whole range of goods and services. You can, if you have questions like this, you can just look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. You can see exactly where goods prices are going up. And you'll see sometimes, yeah, gas is going up. Now, we get this question all the time. And so I thought about this. You know, why is it that the data is showing this and people feel so keenly that it's not true? And I think the answer to it, it's probably a little less true in this part of the world, but more generally, I think what this reflects is that wage growth has been really slow.
Yeah.
And what has happened is there's been a real erosion of people's purchasing power. That's a reflection of low demand. That's a reflection that firms don't feel a need to hire workers, and that means wages aren't growing as fast as they should. But that's a call. If you thought inflation was too high, that means you should cut back on monetary stimulus. If you think the problem is that wages are too low, that means you should add monetary stimulus. So the policy conclusion is very different.
Yeah.
But I think these kinds of questions come from the fact that people feel like they can't afford these goods and services as easily as they could a few years ago.
Well, the next question, which I'm going to comment on a little bit, why won't the Fed agree to open its books to an independent audit? Everything you do affects all U.S. citizens, not just a handful of people. Having served as audit chair of the Fed for the last 3 years and being in a meeting with Deloitte and Touche when some people are outside protesting with signs saying audit the Fed, you wonder what is intended. And not only Deloitte and Touche auditing us, and I go to, in that role, I've gone to Washington twice a year, meeting with Deloitte and Touche there as well. We also have had the GAO audit us, really wanting to find out deep secrets of us. Are we serving on the Fed board for some nefarious reason? You know, there's got to be some hidden reason that you're doing this, and they find out, no, it's public service. And I can tell you all the banks have people who are there strictly out of public service trying to give input to help people like Narayana make better decisions. So you probably want to comment, because this keeps coming up, and there's 100 members of Congress that sign, you know, audit the Fed. You know, what do they mean? I mean, I know what the word audit means in most senses, but there's something deeper about this question.
Yeah, I mean, as you're indicating, Howard, I mean, there's a lot of financial audits of the Fed. For example, you know, you can look online and see exactly what assets we've bought. This is, I'm talking by the number of the bond is available. If you want to track exactly, there's a spreadsheet. You can go look and see exactly the bonds the Fed has bought. And as you said, we have the external audit from Deloitte and Touche. It's done on an annual basis. Every Reserve Bank is audited in this fashion, the Board of Governors. So it's the financial audits are very extensively audited in this fashion. I think the term audit the Fed is a little bit of a misnomer. I think the people who are pushing this kind of legislation really have a different kind of question in mind that they want to be put before the public. And that's a question of, shouldn't Congress have more influence over monetary policy? You know, here at the Federal Reserve is when the people who make monetary policy consist of the Board of Governors in Washington and the 12 Reserve Bank presidents. And these people are all appointed individuals. They're not elected. And you could make an argument that you would like to have more elected individuals having direct influence for monetary policy. Now, my own view on that is that's not the right course to take. If you look at the experiences of a large variety of countries, they've all moved to having the kind of system the U.S. have of having this kind of independent technocratic agency making monetary policy and not elected officials, because the short-term political horizon doesn't go well with sort of the temptations associated with monetary policy. But it's absolutely a legitimate question. I mean, it's a totally reasonable question to ask It's that it's just not about auditing the Fed. It's about the question of should elected officials be the ones that have more control over monetary policy than they currently do. And that's, I think, the way the question should be framed, and that's the way people should talk about it.
Good, thanks. Should we do another one? So how does the Open Market Committee balance the impact of 0% short rates on incomes of savers, particularly retirees, against hopeful stimulative, you know, as we know, a lot of people who were counting on their 5% CDs long-term in retirement, it's have been hit very hard. So
yeah.
What do you have to say to those people?
Yeah, no, and, you know, it turns out I know some of these people quite well, like my mother. But anyways, this issue is a really important one. And so when the Federal Open Market Committee makes monetary policy, as I mentioned, we've been assigned goals by Congress. And that's how we think of our job, is to meet our goals. And what are those goals? They're to promote price stability, that is, keep inflation close to 2%, and to promote maximum employment, to keep unemployment low. So that's our goals. And at that the question then becomes for us, is lowering rates going to provide stimulus on balance? This is a question sort of asked. There are going to be some people, when you keep rates low, for whom the action of low rates will not be stimulative. That's my own view of the situation, because of the fact they're trying to get by rolling over short-term investments. If you're keeping short-term interest rates low, they're going to get very low incomes, and that's going to be challenging for them. But that we have to weigh that fact that they're receiving relatively low stimulus against the fact that it's stimulative in so many other ways for such a wide range of the people in the United States. You know, you're generating upward stimulus on housing prices. You are providing a stimulus in terms of lowering the rates some people pay on car loans. Mortgage rates are lower. So there's just such a huge, wide swath of ways the process is stimulus. The policy is stimulative, that it will swamp these individuals. Even when you think about retirees, a lot of retirees have long-term investments. And they're not going to be affected by, so if you're just receiving a fixed payment every from an annuity, say, or you own stocks, you know, monetary policy stimulus has been certainly very beneficial for you. So we're talking about a group of people that certainly exist, and it's a concern, but in terms of meeting our goals, this is what we have to do. I will say one more thing about this, which is, it is that the FOMC in this situation are actually a victim of the same circumstances that these savers are. And what I mean by that is the reason that we have to keep our policy rate as low as we have to in order to try to meet our goals is for the same reason that these savers are facing such challenges. And it's because everybody in the world wants to save in a safe way now. And there's a lot less stuff to save that way. So you go back to 2007, everyone felt pretty secure in the world, and it seemed like there were a lot of assets were safe. You know, anything backed by U.S. real estate, residential real estate, was a safe asset. Greek sovereign debt looked safe. You know, a lot has changed in the the supply of safe assets has shrunk, and at the same time, people are much more worried and concerned about risks that can affect them. That's why the Fed has to lower its policy rate as much as it does. People aren't willing to spend at the same interest rate. Given an interest rate, people's desire to spend is so much lower. And this is what retirees who are trying to live on rolling over short-term investment are competing against. They're competing against a whole new group of people who are trying to do the same thing as they are. And that's, in economics, that's a very challenging situation you're going to confront yourself with.
Somebody wants to know about Bitcoin. Is Bitcoin affecting in any way the measurement of the money supply? Does the Fed have a position on Bitcoin?
I should have said this right at the beginning, but I'll try to say it now. I'm never speaking for the Fed. I'm only speaking for representing my own views as and those aren't necessarily those of anyone else in the FOMC or the Federal Reserve System. With that said, I don't really have a view on Bitcoin. I would call myself an active learner on it. It's, you know, at this stage, I don't think it's having huge effects on measurements of things like the money supply and economic activity. Bitcoin is very interesting. There's sort of this, it's got this currency aspect to it, which is what's usually emphasized. But it's also got a very interesting payment system aspect to it, that it's a very convenient way for people to pay for goods and services with one another as well. So it's got both those features, certainly very interesting to monitor and keep track of. You know, I'm not sitting here and thinking, boy, Bitcoin is going to run the US dollar out of business. I don't see that in the near-term future. I do think that, you know, I think it's interesting to think about, can these kinds of innovations make payments more faster among individuals? You know, and right now, if you write a check, it takes time for it to clear. And Bitcoin, it takes 10 minutes for a transaction to take place. So, you know, that's where I think the interest of it is for myself, as opposed to the idea that this is a new currency that's going to drive the U.S. dollar out of circulation.
The correlation between $17 trillion of debt, and I'm assuming that number, $17 trillion, is amalgamation of a whole bunch of things together, and economic growth. Is there a correlation between the debt number and slow growth?
Well, this was a huge controversy in the economics world, actually, because there was a study by a couple of Harvard professors that had documented that there was a ceiling on how high debt could get before you would start to experience low growth. And $17 trillion would be above that ceiling. It was about 90% of GDP. But it turned out that there was a programming error in their work. And so actually that correlation doesn't hold up. I think that, you know, I think it's a tricky question. The causation issue is really hard because countries that are facing a bad recession like we just went through often borrow a lot during that time period. And so you could easily see a run-up in debt during a slow growth period. I don't know which way that causation is supposed to go. So I guess it's a long way to say that I don't see a correlation like this. You know, I look at the U.S. after World War II, which is the one time, you know, you look back throughout U.S. history and our debt-to-GDP ratio was a little bit higher, I think, than we have right now. We certainly grew very rapidly after World War II. So it's not a matter of statistical inevitability of what happens in terms of growth just because debt is as high as it is. The right question to ask about debt is not what the level is right now. There is really the key question we have to ask ourselves as Americans about the debt is not about how high the debt is now. It is about the fact that we have made commitments to our older citizens, and we're going to have a lot more of those older citizens when they, certainly in the next part, the early part of the next decade, it's going to start. It really hit us. We're going to have a lot more people who are going to be owed Medicare, Social Security, and we're going to have a lot fewer people working. That tension is the tension. This number is not the important number. The important number is how many people are going to be hitting retirement age and how few people are going to be behind them working. That's the real tension that we have to be concerned about.
And you at the Fed cannot answer. That's a question for Congress. So,
well, it's a question. It's a question for Congress, yeah, as our representatives. But really, it's a question for us,
for
all of us as Americans.
We the people.
We the people. Congress is definitely split on how to deal with this issue. But in my conversations with Americans throughout my district and outside of the district, that's representative of a split among us as people.
Well, let's do one more here. I think we're getting to the end of mine, but the sluggish recovery has been going on for years now. Have we entered a new phase of slow growth? Are we like Japan? And then the second question, is the government the only answer to get things going, which is sort of a loaded question.
Yeah, I'm... You know, I think this is a question we struggle with on an ongoing basis, is have we entered a new phase of slow growth? I was just at a conference on this that over the weekend where this question was discussed at some length. You know, the key to this, key to growth in over the longer haul is what's called total factor productivity growth. There's a fancy way of saying is how efficiently, what kind of innovations, how fast do innovations come along that allow us to make use of labor and capital more effectively? And what's a little bit concerning is that the rate of growth along those lines has slowed, and that slowing started to take place really in going back about 2004 or so. There was a real burst of growth between 1995 and 2004, which people typically associate with computers and the internet. And then since then, 2004 onwards, we haven't seen the same rate of growth. The good news is that it turns out to be pretty random. Sometimes you can easily have good growth and following a period of slow growth. And we just, you know, I think in terms of government, I'm very much a free market guy. I have a PhD from the University of Chicago. And no, government is not the only answer. Government is part of the answer insofar as it's got to provide the right backdrop for people to be able to do innovation, to provide the right backdrop for us to be able to be effective in terms of what we do economically. You know, you need to have a court system. You need to have contracts. That's sort of the basic structure of what you do has to have that. And I think you have to have, I think when people write contracts with one another, you need to have stable prices. You have to know what's going to happen with prices over time. And so you need good monetary policy as well.
Does anybody have a hand question, or we're going to continue with does an increase in the minimum wage increase unemployment?
So this is a great question because in some sense it, so if I had been asked this question, I went to enter college in 1979. And one of the things that economists, you know, you're always talking about all the things that economists don't agree on. One of the things economists did agree on in 1979 was on this question, that an increase in the minimum wage would increase unemployment. And the basic idea was that if you increase, put a floor on wages that employers can pay, there's going to be a group of people who would be willing to work at less than that wage, and employers would be willing to hire them, and they wouldn't be able to make a contract. So that was the theory. And it's a real testimony to what's happened in economics since I was in school in 1979 that was all we had was theory. Now, since then, we've had a lot of empirical work. And the answer just turns out to be a lot murkier than we would have thought. That basic intuitive theory, I think all economists agree that it's true in the sort of some exaggerated extreme. So if you went from 7.25 to 72.50, yeah, that would increase unemployment. But smaller changes, I think that in some cases they've been shown to actually be associated with increasing employment. And so it's I think it's harder to sort out than, so I don't have any kind of definitive answer to that except in the real extremes.
So in Williston, our minimum wage is, I think, $18.50 an hour right now, so.
Yeah, they're, yeah.
David, another? We've only got time for a couple more questions. Oh boy, love to hear your thoughts on the evolution of Fed from Greenspan to Bernanke to Yellen. And you know, let's add a little twist. Why don't you give everybody a flavor of what it's like to sit at the Open Market Committee with a bunch of really interesting people and you know, your conversation around the room. So I think this is a great place to end because we are gonna bump up against the clock. But that's a lot to...
Well, I can shorten it because I actually never worked with Chairman Greenspan. Chairman Greenspan retired in 2006, and so I never worked with him. I worked with Chairman Bernanke and now Chair Yellen. And, you know, what it was the greatest... I've gotten used to it to a certain extent, but to walk into that room with the... It's a large oval table. I mean, man, it must be 30 feet long. And there's a map of the United States divided into districts at the one end of the room. And the group of people I get to work with, my fellow Federal Open Markets Committee members and participants, the other presidents and the governors, It's just a remarkable group of people in terms of the energy they bring, the dedication they bring. We don't always all agree, but the discussion is always really much grounded in very much in sort of technical issues about what's a lot of the questions we've been talking about. Is the decline in employment we've seen, is that should we think about it as being permanent or temporary? And you know, these are economic issues, and that's what we grapple with on an ongoing basis. And Chairman Bernanke was a great person to facilitate those kinds of discussions and, of course, lead us as well. A brilliant economist, but also a person who really wanted to get at the right answer. And he was willing to admit that he didn't always know the right answers, and I think that's very important. There was a huge amount of respect in that room for him, partly because of what he did in 2008, but just partly as a leader of our organization. You know, Chair Yellen, Janet, as I've known her for a long time, now she was a fellow president of mine when I first became president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. She was a president of the San Francisco Fed. And then she was named vice chair, I should say, of the Board of Governors in 2010. She's just a remarkable person herself, just really deeply caring about trying to do the job before us. Also a great economist. I think she'll be a tremendous leader for our organization. You know, I think one thing that Chairman Bernanke had as an ambition is to make the Fed less about these people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how successful that he's been ultimately. I mean, I think the fact that he saved the world through his decisions in 2008 made him even more of a hero in popular culture. But I think that would be a healthy thing for the organization to broaden out the perspectives that the country has about what the FOMC is, to be really more about the committee than being about any particular person.
So to be clear, each of you gets a chance to speak what you're thinking about and debate.
So I can go on about this. So the way the conversation is very structured. So in general, so we each speak in turn about the economy, all 12 presidents, and then all the governors each speak in turn about the economy. Occasionally there'll be some give and take. So after someone speaks, you can have what's called a two-handed intervention. This was innovation of Chairman Bernanke's, where you could raise both your hands, and then you could say, somebody could say to me, very respectfully, President Coach Lakota, what you just said made absolutely no sense. Could you explain it? No, I mean, the idea would be then to ask a question to have some give and take. But in general, there's not very little of that. The give and take takes place over time as opposed to within the meeting. I'm going over too fast here. So there's a second go-round after this first one, which is about policy. We'll each speak in turn about our views on policy, and then the chair will summarize where the committee's ended up. What I was going to say is the give and take is really more over time. That I will say something, or another president, or one of the governors will say something, and people will tend not to respond in the meeting itself. They'll go back and consult with staff and say, "What did X mean by that?" And then they'll come back having consulted with that and said, "I checked with my staff. Here's what they think of what you said." So. I think some people think this is, the fact we're so deliberative, I think is frustrating for, at times, people would like to have more of a free-flowing conversation. I myself think it's a very positive thing. I think it makes us a more thoughtful body to have us reacting more over time as opposed to in the heat of the moment. It's just an incredibly rewarding experience to be able to work with such an amazing group of people.
Well, let's give a hand to Narayana.
Yeah, thanks for the great questions. It was a real pleasure to be here.
And thanks to NDSU for making, Kelly and team, for making all the arrangements and the invites, and it's been great.